Hi, everyone, and welcome back to the 19th video of the Old Testament Survey course. In this section, we're looking at the book of Judges. As usual, let's start with some background issues. I think the best way to describe the book of Judges is that it is Joshua's evil twin. In Joshua, we saw faith and obedience, and the blessing and success of the people of God conquering and inheriting the land. In Judges, we see rebellion and idolatry, and the punishment and tragedy that results. You might recall that the primary history draws on Deuteronomistic theology to tell its story. Well, these two books show this on a large scale. Just as Joshua was a positive success story, Judges overall is a story of massive failure and unfaithfulness, and Israel pays the price. Therefore, Judges is a fairly depressing book, but it serves a necessary function for our faith, to serve as a warning, as well as to point us away from futile hope in ourselves to a bigger hope in God and His plan. The name of this book comes from the Hebrew word used to describe the series of main characters in the book. It's related to the word for justice and means something like those who do justice. Therefore, in English, it's typically translated simply as judges. In a few minutes, we'll look at this title and the activities of these leaders in more detail. The authorship of the book is technically anonymous. Some traditions suggest Samuel is the author, but there's no way to know for sure. The time period covered by Judges is just after the history covered in Joshua. It is the history of the next generation after Joshua's generation conquered the land. And the book was probably written at the time of the early monarchy, around the time of Saul and David. The book of Judges is characterized by some very interesting and exciting stories. These are some of the Bible stories that are taught to children because they have exciting heroes and battles and miraculous victories. But some of the stories have fairly adult content. And all the stories are told for a theological reason, to demonstrate how God deals with his people and the implications of this for how God's people should live. Now let's look at the organization of Judges with the outline of this book. The introduction to the book in the first section stresses that the conquest was incomplete, and the work of completing the conquest had stalled, and God's people fell into idolatry with the remaining nations. Then the main central section has the stories of 12 judges. These stories typically display a cyclical pattern that was introduced in the first section of the book, as we'll see in a moment. This repeated pattern happens many times in the central section. First, the nation sins by idolatry. As a result, God sends a nation to oppress them. Then the people cry out to God, and God raises up a deliverer to rescue them. So the judge is victorious and the oppressor is defeated, and the people have rest. This cycle repeats in the stories of the individual judges in this central section. And then is the final section, which is not about an individual judge, but it tells stories that highlight Israel's apostasy, which results in total anarchy, which point to their need for a king. So the overall outline of this book is fairly simple, and we see a repeated pattern for many of the stories. Now let's look at the content of Judges, starting with some key verses. First is Judges chapter 2, verses 1 through 3, and this says, "The angel of the Lord said, 'I brought you up out of Egypt and led you into the land that I swore to give to your forefathers. I said, I will never break my covenant with you, and you shall not make a covenant with the people of this land, but you shall break down their altars. Yet you have disobeyed me. Why have you done this? Now, therefore, I tell you that I will not drive them out before you. They will be thorns in your sides, and their gods will be a snare to you.'" In this message from God to Israel, he rehearsed his goodness and commands, and he accused them of disobedience. And he told them that the nations that they failed to conquer would be their punishment. Because they had failed to obey God in completing the conquest, ironically, it would be even more difficult to complete the conquest, because God would no longer fight for them. Therefore, their first necessary task was repentance and removing all idolatry and restoring faithfulness to God. And then they would be able to get back to the task of completing the conquest, but not before. Yet, as we'll see, because they kept being unfaithful to God, everything else got worse as well. Next is Judges 2, verses 10 through 19. Among other things, this passage describes the repeated pattern that I just mentioned in the outline, so listen for it as I read these verses, which say, "After that whole generation had been gathered to their fathers, another generation grew up who knew neither Yahweh nor what he had done for Israel. Then the Israelites did evil in the eyes of Yahweh and served the Baals. They forsook Yahweh, the God of their fathers, who had brought them out of Egypt. They followed and worshipped various gods of the peoples around them. They provoked Yahweh to anger because they forsook him and served Baal and the Ashtoreths. In his anger against Israel, Yahweh handed them over to raiders who plundered them. He sold them to their enemies all around, whom they were no longer able to resist. Whenever Israel went out to fight, the hand of Yahweh was against them to defeat them, just as he had sworn to them. They were in great distress. Then Yahweh raised up judges who saved them out of the hands of these raiders, yet they would not listen to their judges, but prostituted themselves to other gods and worshipped them. Unlike their fathers, they quickly turned from the way in which their fathers had walked, the way of obedience to Yahweh's commands. Whenever Yahweh raised up a judge for them, he was with the judge and saved them out of the hands of their enemies as long as the judge lived, for Yahweh had compassion on them as they groaned under those who oppressed and afflicted them. But when the judge died, the people returned to ways even more corrupt than those of their fathers, following other gods and serving and worshiping them. They refused to give up their evil practices and stubborn ways." Now, this passage summarizes the experience of Israel during this period, and therefore it serves as an outline for the repeated cycle of judges that we just looked at. Each of those six items is described in this passage. They forsook the one true God and served false gods with their idols. The Lord handed them over to their enemies. He actually fought against them. And it says this was just like God had sworn to them, referring back to the warnings in Deuteronomy. Therefore, the people were in great distress. The Lord raised up judges. The judges saved them from their enemies, and they had rest as long as the judge lived because of God's compassion and grace toward them. After the judge died, they returned to their idolatry and unfaithfulness, and the cycle started over again. That is the pattern for the individual stories in the section that follows. And therefore, each of the judge episodes should be read in light of this summary paradigm. The next key verse is a phrase that happens in multiple verses. It says, "But when they cried out to Yahweh, he raised up for them a deliverer." This tells how God gave them an individual called a judge to be the agent of their rescue. God worked through leadership, which he raised up and empowered for their task. But remember, the judge is not the hero of these stories, God is. And in many of these episodes, it clearly states that the judge was able to bring victory because the Spirit of the Lord rushed upon him and empowered him for the task. Judges 6, verses 6 through 10 is next. And it says, "Midian so impoverished the Israelites that they cried out to Yahweh for help. When the Israelites cried to Yahweh because of Midian, he sent them a prophet who said, 'This is what Yahweh, the God of Israel, says. I brought you up out of Egypt, out of the land of slavery. I snatched you from the power of Egypt and from the hand of all your oppressors. I drove them from before you and gave you their land. I said to you, I am Yahweh your God. Do not worship the gods of the Amorites in whose land you live. But you've not listened to me." In this passage, Israel was going around the cycle again, crying out to God because they were oppressed. But this time, before he helped them, God gave them an earful. He rebuked them for their unfaithfulness, especially in light of all that he had done for them. And he reminded them that he is Yahweh their God. So their chasing other gods is not only stupid, but also an affront to his holy greatness. Next is Judges 8, verses 22 and 23. The Israelites said to Gideon, "Rule over us, you, your son, and your grandson, because you have saved us out of the hand of Midian." But Gideon told them, "I will not rule over you, nor will my son rule over you. Yahweh will rule over you." Now, this passage is pointing forward to the concept of monarchy, the idea of a king ruling over Israel that we'll see in later Old Testament books. However, Gideon made the point that he and his family will not rule over them. And the reason he gave is that God is the true king over Israel. God is the king of Israel in a way that no human ever could be. But there's also another side of the preparation for monarchy, which comes in the next key verse, which is a phrase that appears in a few passages. For instance, Judges 17:6 says, "In those days, Israel had no king. Everyone did as he saw fit." Judges 18:1 says, "In those days, Israel had no king." And Judges 21:25 says, "In those days, Israel had no king. Everyone did as he saw fit." Notice that the book of Judges implies that the lack of a king is a bad thing, and that this is the reason that everyone did whatever they wanted, which was also a very bad thing. Some translations render this more literally as everyone did what was right in his own eyes. Everyone decided for themselves what was right and wrong. And that kind of anarchy and lawlessness was definitely not what God wanted for his people. And therefore, something had to change. This points forward to the idea of a king over Israel, which will be realized in later books. The sad state of Israel in the book of Judges is a problem, and later books will demonstrate the God-given solution. Like I said, Judges is a depressing book, but it is part of the larger story of the Old Testament, preparing for something greater. All right, these are some of the key ideas from Judges. Now, let's continue in the content of Judges by working through each of the sections. In the introductory section, Judges emphasizes that the conquest was incomplete, it had stalled, and Israel should complete it. And then it mentions that Joshua's generation was gone. It repeats the idea from Joshua 24:31 that the people faithfully served the Lord in Joshua's lifetime. And this sets up the contrast with the next generation. It says the next generation were idolaters. But the reason given was that they did not know what the Lord had done. Now, think about it. How could that happen? I think this points, at least partly, to a failure of their parents' generation, which did not pass on their faith to their children. They did not teach their sons and daughters what the Lord had done. And this was also a failure of the Levites, who did not teach them the way of the Lord. And that's a lesson each of us needs to learn, because the church is always only one generation away from extinction if we don't reach the younger generation. And let's be honest, the forces of evil are working hard to reach your children with their falsehoods. John Flavel once asked, "If you neglect to instruct your children in the way of holiness, will the devil neglect to instruct them in the way of wickedness?" You see, the next generation matters. Therefore, make sure to serve the Lord in such a way that the next generation will follow him. Live in such a way that your great-grandchildren will be blessed by your godly heritage. But in the case of Judges, the next generation was unfaithful to the Lord and went after other gods, which started the repeated cycle of the Judges. And that brings us to the main part of this book, the cycles of Judges. Now, when we hear the word judge in our culture, we typically think of a person who makes a decision on legal matters. But when the word judge is used in the book of Judges, it does not primarily have this meaning. Like I mentioned earlier, it is related to the idea of justice, and it means something like the one who administers justice, the one who carries out or enforces justice. So the term judge in the book of Judges basically means a leader who carries out justice. They occasionally made legal decisions, but they were all-around leaders who primarily administered justice in military matters, because that was the type of leadership and justice that was needed at that time. And their work was in conformity with God's definition of justice. The central section of Judges tells the story of 12 judges in Israel. There are major judges and minor judges. And like with the major and minor prophets, the terms major and minor refer to the length of each judge's story, not their significance. Some stories are just a few verses, and some cover multiple chapters, but they are all important. And notice from this map that the judges ruled in different places and among different tribes of Israel. Because the judges judged in different places in Israel, this brings up two possibilities when it comes to the chronology of the book of Judges. These stories could have happened one after another, or some of the stories could have taken place at the same time in different places, so that the stories would overlap in time. And I mention this because this is what explains the two different possible dates for the Exodus. If the judges were one after another, the early date of the Exodus and conquest is necessary. But if they overlap, the later date is at least possible. The book of Judges itself does not give us any indication which of these two chronologies is more likely true. And in all the narratives of individual judges, as long as their story is told in enough detail, they follow the pattern we looked at earlier. However, if we look at the 12 judges as a whole, each successive judge and story gets worse. Othniel and Ehud, the first judges, are mostly positive and godly. Gideon, in the middle, is a wishy-washy leader, neither good or bad. And by the time we get to Samson, he's a sleaze. You would not want your son to grow up to be like Samson. Therefore, the overall cycle of judges illustrate the steady decline of Israel. Now, we don't have time to go through each judge in detail. Let me mention a few of the judges just to illustrate. The story of the first two judges, Othniel and Ehud, follow the cyclical pattern. Each story tells what happens in the sequence of these six steps of the cycle, which is clearly demonstrated in each case. And the story of Ehud adds some details about him being left-handed and how this enabled him to sneak in a weapon, because they apparently only checked where a right-handed man would keep his weapon, and how he killed the fat king and escaped and then led Israel to victory. Next is Shamgar, whose story is told in only one verse, chapter 3, verse 31, with very little detail given. And we're told that he saved Israel by striking down 600 Philistines with an ox goad, which is basically a pointed stick. But think about it. If only one man was able to save Israel from so many enemies with just a pointed stick, then you know that God was with him. Then is the story of Barak, which is also the story of Deborah. And this story is actually told twice, once with straightforward prose in chapter 4, and then again in a poetic retelling in chapter 5. And this story demonstrates that the leaders were starting to get worse. Barak lacked faith and had to be goaded into leading. Bruce Waltke wrote, "The contrast between Deborah and Barak suggests that God raised up a woman to lead Israel because the Israelite men were cowards and declined leadership." And therefore, Barak does not get credit for killing the enemy leader. Rather, that was done by another woman named Jael. And this story contains another sandwich structure, which highlights the fact that it is God who defeated the enemy and gave them into Israel's hand. And the punchline of the poetic retelling is that God's enemies will perish, and those who love him will flourish. Next is Gideon. This story is told in such a way to make it plain that only God is responsible for the victory. The account starts with a rebuke from God to his people because they had fallen into idolatry and were being oppressed as punishment. And Gideon was afraid and had to be convinced by God to stand up against the oppressors. Again, the quality of the judges is going down as the book progresses. And the first thing God required from Gideon was to cut down the idol in his own hometown. God made Gideon war against idolatry before he could go to war against the oppression. Then God made Gideon reduce the size of his army so that it was evident to everyone that the army was not the cause of their victory. They raised a war cry in the name of Yahweh, and the enemies all fled in panic. Gideon pursued and defeated the oppressors because God fought for them. Gideon was then offered the title of king, but he refused. And the punchline of that episode is that only God is king of Israel. Gideon passed the test of kingship, but later he failed when he made an object that became an idol which was worshipped. So as a leader, Gideon was both a success and a failure. Then after Gideon's death, a man named Abimelech, who was an illegitimate son of Gideon, he conspired with his hometown to seize the kingship over Israel for himself by killing Gideon's legitimate sons. He was rebuked with a fable about the trees of the forest choosing a thorn bush to rule over them because all the valuable trees did not want to be king. And the point of that fable is that the people would get what they asked for. The kind of king they got would determine whether the king would be a blessing or a curse. And because of that twisted arrangement, the trees and thorn bush would end up destroying each other. And this came true in the life of Abimelech. The people who conspired with him to make him king ended up conspiring against him, and they destroyed each other. The people of God had become their own enemies and oppressors because Abimelech tried to be king on his own, completely ignoring God. In that whole episode, God is only mentioned at the start when it says they ignored him and went after idols, and then when it says that God punished them all by turning them against each other to destroy each other. So they tried to have kingship without God, and it ruined everything. Again, the point is made that only God is king over Israel. And finally, I want to mention Samson. Now, there's a ton in the Samson story, and I wish we had time to cover it. Yes, Samson was a sleaze. He was a woman chaser whose lust got him into trouble. He was specially called by God and set aside from birth, but he gave in to the manipulations of women who did not have his best interest in mind because he was attracted to them. He was led away from wisdom and righteousness by a pretty face and sweet talk, just like Proverbs chapter 5 will warn young men to avoid. And yet, God used him. And it turns out that Samson was the only one fighting God's wars at that time. God used Samson's lust as the means to pick a fight with the Philistines. Samson was actually completing the conquest when the rest of Israel had given up. And when he got in trouble, he was a man of prayer. This story shows how far Israel had fallen by contrast with Samson. If Samson the sleaze was the best of Israel, what does that say about the rest of Israel? They were not fighting God's wars. They were no longer completing the conquest. They were no longer even crying out to God when they were oppressed. They had completely given up. And in the middle of the Samson story, the tribe of Judah even worked against Samson on the side of the Philistines. So the story of Samson is not primarily about a haircut or a jawbone or even supernatural strength. It is a contrast between what Israel should have been and what it turned out to be, so that even a sleaze like Samson makes the rest of Israel look bad by comparison. That is how low Israel had fallen in the cycle of judges. And they would fall even further. And we see that in the last section of the book, which shows their complete anarchy and lawlessness. There are two main stories in this last section, which I'm taking for granted that you've read because they were assigned in the reading schedule. These are not nice stories, but they are true and have much to teach us by negative example. In the first story, the tribe of Dan stole and worshipped an idol and ambushed an innocent city, which God had not told them to fight against. They failed to conquer the place that God had given them, and they stole a place that God had not allotted to them. They were acting like the Canaanite nations before them who had deserved to be dispossessed. They had fallen into complete anarchy through their idolatry. And in the second story, a Levite's concubine was brutally killed by some from the tribe of Benjamin, and as a result, the entire tribe of Benjamin was almost completely wiped out. And this story has many similarities to the story of Sodom back in Genesis. That is how bad Israel had become. They were almost as bad as Sodom. And as a result, they were on the verge of extinction. By the end of the book of Judges, Israel had become as bad as the nations that they had conquered. What a tragic story. Something needs to change. They need a king. Like I said, the book of Judges is depressing overall, even though there are high points in the stories. And those high points of rescue are only because of God's mercy and faithfulness to his covenant, even when his people are unfaithful. These stories are honestly recorded, including all the failure to demonstrate the theological message of this book. And that naturally transitions into the theological themes of Judges. First is the cyclical pattern, and that is textbook Deuteronomistic theology. When they follow idols, they are oppressed. When they cry out to God, he saves them. The point is that his people should flee idolatry and avoid any compromise with the nations. But they don't, so they live to regret it. The second theme is God's faithful rescue. God is a powerful, compassionate, loving, faithful God who rescues those who don't deserve his rescue, solely because of his gracious nature. Now, we should take heart in this, but not presume upon it. And consequently, we should not automatically give up on people who hurt us, but we should follow God's example of extending grace and forgiveness. Yet, God's patience does have an end, and he is not to be trifled with. And the third theme is the need to complete the conquest. The people stopped moving forward with God's mission, and so they fell back. They did not zealously pursue what God had called them to do. They should not have let the momentum of spiritual growth and progress stop. And that's a lesson for us. Whenever we make peace with pockets of sin in our lives, no matter how small, they will come back to haunt us. The fact that they had trouble completing the conquest was a continual problem for Israel, which will come up in later books as well. And the final theme is the need for a king. The fact that they were falling into idolatry and anarchy shows the need for unifying leadership that will lead them in a better direction. Now, we've seen a mixed message about kings in the book of Judges. On the one hand, Gideon rightly rejected kingship because only God is king. And Abimelech's attempt to make himself a king without God ended in complete disaster. But on the other hand, by the end of the book, their lack of leadership had caused tremendous problems. And the book clearly says that their anarchy happened because there was no king, suggesting that they needed a ruler. Now, the other nations had kings, so merely having a king is not enough. We'll see in the books of Samuel and Kings that what really matters is what kind of king that they have. But in the book of Judges, the point is that what they had at that time was not working, because everyone did what they wanted, and they usually wanted sinful things. Something needed to change, but not in the direction of what the other nations had. So the book of Judges serves to teach that Israel left on their own does not keep the covenant. They need a leader. They need a special kind of leader. They need a savior. Just being in the promised land was not enough. Even with every benefit and blessing, even with God's perfect instructions, and even with God regularly fighting on their behalf, they still were unfaithful. Something else is needed. They need a savior. So the book of Judges leaves us hanging with an unfinished story and an expectation for something more. Something has to change. Now, I sure hope that the subsequent books give answers to this problem. Now, you'll have to come back as we survey the later books to find out. But I think you've been given fairly good hints about what will happen later in the story. But for now, let's review the book of Judges. In terms of the organization of Judges, what I would like you to remember is the cycle of Judges. And for review, I've simplified it down to just four terms: sin, oppression, crying out, and rescue. And you can use the word soccer to help you remember the cycle of Judges. And the themes of Judges are cyclical pattern, God's rescue, complete the conquest, and the need for a king. And you can use the word kigikin. Sorry, they don't all work out as something memorable. All right, that's all for the book of Judges. Overall, it's a sad story, but an important lesson for us to learn. In the next section, we'll look at the book of Ruth, which starts to bring hope. And I hope you join us. Thanks for watching.